The following shiur has been presented by Rav Yitzchak Grossman, Dayan at the Beis Havad, and has been brought to you by the Beis Havad Halacha Center.
Yoma, Daf Chav Tesim and Beis, Lamer Amin Aleph, Amar Rabbi Abba, Zot Amaret, Mitzvah L'Shapshik. A man is commanded to wipe, to clean himself after urination. Rashi explains he has to clean the Nitzotah Shomei Raglayim, the drops of urine, Hanitazin Al Raglav, that have dripped, sprayed on his feet. He should not appear publicly with that urine upon him. He will appear to be a krus shafcha, a man with damaged reproductive organs in such a way that he would be sterile. The reason urine would be an evidence of this is because someone with such damage, his urine does not spray or is not emitted forcefully, rather it drips, it dribbles, a krus shafcha in a molot. Such a person would be sterile. People will say that his children, the children of his wife, are not his. They are mamzerim. The Gemara explains, a person is prohibited from going outside in public with the urine. This will engender malicious gossip that his children, his putative children, are really not his and are really mamzer. This Gemara is just talking about laz, malicious gossip. The basic concern appears in Yevamos and Dafayin Hay in the sugya of Krus Shafcha as an actual din, as an actual conclusive presumption. The Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, Ezo Ptuadaka, what is the definition of the Ptuadaka of the Torah who is considered sterile and prohibited from marrying a normal Bat Yisrael? One of the examples, one of the definitions of a Ptuad Parsa, the definition of Ptuad Naka is a puncture. The Gemara asks, is it really true that Nikev, a puncture, someone with a puncture, cannot father a child? The Hu Gavra, the Selik Ladikla, a man climbed a tree, had an unfortunate accident, Charze Silva Bebeim, he was punctured by a thorn. Nevertheless, he fathered children. Mara says, nope. Ashalach Shmuel, Kamei Darav, Amar Le, Teva Chazer Albana Me'ayin Hein. Go find out who is really the father of these children. So the Gemara takes for granted that a Ptuadaka, a Krus Shafcha, is sterile, cannot have children. And if his wife has borne children, we presume that these children are not his. We find out who the father really is. Similarly, the Gemara, several Daphim later, brings the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda that a tumtum, a person with ambiguous gender, is sterile even if he's torn open surgically and we find that he has zacharis, that he has male organs, nevertheless he is presumed sterile. So the Gemara says there was a certain case of a tumtum, da usbua bekurse veikra v'olud shevavnin. He did father seven children. Rabbi Yehuda, go find out who the father really is. We have a halachic presumption that he is sterile. Evidence to the contrary is not accepted. We assume that the woman was promiscuous and the children are not really his. This presumption of the Gemara that a Ptuadaka must be sterile and therefore evidence of fertility would refute the status of his being a Ptuadaka is a central point in a major machlokas between Rabbeinu Tam and many of the other Rishonim on the one hand, versus the Bahag, the Rambam, the Ramban, many other Rishonim on the other, about Nitel Be'ah Achas. A person who has damaged or is missing one of his Be'ahim, is he considered a Ptuadaka Krus Shafcha or not? Rabbeinu Tam was lenient, many other Rishonim were Machmer, although many Rishonim were Mekel like Rabbeinu Tam. Great deal of discussion in the Achronim. While much of the discussion has to do with a careful reading of the Bavli and other Talmudic sources, Shalmi, other sources, one of the central points of discussion was Rabbeinu Tam's argument that it cannot be that a person missing one Be'ah is a Ptuadaka and therefore sterile, because as Tosus cites Rabbeinu Tam, HaChazninan Kama B'nei Adam Shekarsim Be'achas Malidin. We find many people who have had one Be'ah amputated and they father children successfully. Now, you could say what the Gemara said, Teva Chazer al Bana Me'ayin Hein. Rabbeinu Tam says, no, Lo Mistaver Lomer Teva Chazer al Bnei Me'ayin Hein. Sounds like Rabbeinu Tam means, if there would just be one example, an outlier, it could be a question of Mamzerus, but it's a fairly common occurrence. Kama Bnei Adam. It's unreasonable, it's implausible to say that there's so much promiscuity and so much faithlessness going on the part of the women. And it's always a difficult thing to do, to say that there are so many Mamzerim. Ramban cites Rabbeinu Tam, even though he himself disagrees, cites Rabbeinu Tam as saying, Maisim b'chol yom zimolidim, common everyday occurrence that they're fertile and they do father children. Vim tomar chazer al b'nei me'ayinhein, atamar b'mamzerim b'Yisrael. You're going to greatly increase the number of mamzerim, which Rabbeinu Tam held was untenable. The Rishonim who disagree with Rabbeinu Tam, the Ramban himself and others, the pashtus is, the straightforward approach is, they also accept the principle that a Ptuadaka absolutely cannot father a child, he would be sterile. They just say, as Rabbeinu Tam himself said, maybe we'll say what the Gemara said, say v'chazer al b'nei me'ayinhein. So it's pretty clear that the Gemara is pretty clear, that anyone who is a Ptuadaka cannot be molid, and in principle, if someone is molid, that would refute his status of Ptuadaka. However, if we know someone is a Ptuadaka, we therefore say, say v'chazer al b'nei me'ayinhein, we presume that the children are not actually his. This is indeed how the Beis Shmuel and most Achronim rule. Beis Shmuel says in Siman Hey in Eben Ezer, the beginning of the Siman of Tuadaka, Be'echad Mikal Elu, anyone who meets any of the criteria of Tuadaka, Bechezka Sheinam Oledu, there is an absolute presumption that he is sterile, that he cannot father a child. Vimnasa Isha V'holed Banim, if he marries and does seem to have fathered children, we know for certain these are not his children. They are presumed to be mamzerim. Discussion of mamzerim vade, mamzerim safek. But the Beis Shmuel and most achronim say that since we have this ironclad rule that if Tuadaka is not fertile, then apparent fertility has to be dismissed. We have to assume that the children born by his wife are really someone else's and are really therefore mamzerim. The law, Western law generally also has a conclusive presumption that the children of a married couple are from the husband. Halacha has that too. Rav Bila Sachar Abal, children generally are presumed to be from the husband. However, the law traditionally has taken a much stronger view. The law has typically considered that presumption to be irrebuttable, irrefutable. We don't even accept evidence to the contrary. Famous Supreme Court decision, Michael H., there was a California statute which declared the presumption irrebuttable, and in recent years, especially, courts have begun to be mafakfake in these presumptions because today we have reliable scientific means of forensic testing, a topic we shall return to later, and the question was, does it violate the due process rights of men for the law to blindly declare a conclusive presumption regardless of evidence to the contrary? So actually, Justice Scalia, writing for the court, said that it is perfectly legitimate for the state to have a conclusive presumption that the children are the husband, any evidence to the contrary notwithstanding. And he seems to have understood, as we would say in Lamdus and Yeshivish, that it's a din rather than just a chazaka. It's a din of fraternity rather than a matias of fraternity. Scalia had said that, citing approvingly the appellate court ruling, the lower court ruling, the conclusive presumption is actually a substantive rule of law. Why? Because it's a matter of overriding social policy that we should hold the husband responsible for the child. Integrity of the family unit should not be impugned. So it's not a question of a chazaka, a simple presumption. It's a din. He is a din of the father. Other justices, Justice Brennan, Justice Marshall, Justice Blackmun, they consider this pretty much specious sophistry. They said it doesn't work. Maybe every conclusive presumption is sort of a din. Every chazaka can be looked at as a din. But in which case, it's a din which is based on a matias, they say, and due process requires that we allow the interested party to rebut the matias. In any event, whatever the secular law says, halacha on the one hand does generally have a chazaka that the children of a married couple are children of the husband, he's the father. However, that can be rebutted, and this is one major example in a case where the husband is known to be sterile because he's a psuadaka or a kras shavcha as defined by the halacha. Then he is known to be sterile. He is presumed, therefore, not to be the father, unlike a regular husband who is presumed to be the father. And we say the kids are mamzerim, as the Beis Shmuel rules, as most achronim rule, the kids are becheskes mamzerim in such a case. There is a dissenting view. As we noted previously, Rabbeinu Tam's view is that someone missing, amputated one beya, then he can father children. And his proof is, ma'isim b'chol yom, that such people are successful fathers. As we noted, many Rishonim disagree. Now, the simple explanation of why they disagree is they say, as the Gemara said, Seva Chazar al Bnei Me'ayin Hein, the children must be Mamzer. But that's obviously somewhat dachuk, because as Rabbeinu Tam said, Lomastaber, Lomar, such a thing. So many women are, so many Benos Yisrael, who are not known to be promiscuous, who are Bechetzet Kashrus, are really really adulterous. Difficult to say that. So an additional resolution for these Rishonim was expressed by the Levush. The Levush says, even though we see these women give birth, and apparently we assume that the husband is indeed the father, so he is fertile, nevertheless, ein lachshiro b'kach lavo b'kol. His fertility is not sufficient evidence to refute the presumption that he is a Tzuadaka or a Kris Shavcha. Da'afal pi shamolid, even though he fathers a child, mikol makom b'chlal d'lo yav anasi v'charesu, he still has the status of a Tzuadaka or a Kris Shavcha, nasik v'chares, and he is prohibited from marrying. So the Levush makes sense that it's certainly possible conceptually that a Tzuadaka can father a child, but it seems to be directly violating the Gemara. The Gemara says that a Tzuadaka cannot be molded, and you have to say, Teva Chazar al-Bnei Me'ayinhein. So how can the Levush just disregard a Gemara like this? Many Acharonim have rejected the Levush because of it, the issue with Yaakov, the Beis Meir. Many Acharonim say it just can't be, it's against the Gemara. There are, however, some Acharonim who defend the Levush, with Yaakov Emdin and his Igeres Bikaras, and the Derech Chaim, the Kusi Yagin Aleinu, and his Shuvas. They both say more or less the same thing, that at least l'matkan of the Gemara, there is indeed no conclusive presumption that a Tzuadaka cannot father a child. It could be. Yaakov Emdin mentions the famous Rashba. The Gemara says that a trefa, an animal with the condition that Halacha defines as a trefa, ain't a chaya, cannot live more than a certain amount of time. And Rishonim, various Rishonim were consulted about cases where there was testimony, there were observations that they did, contrary to the assumptions of Chazal. So how can that be? So the Rashba said, the Halacha's definition of trefa is the Halachic definition, it stands, no matter how much evidence you bring to the contrary, nevertheless, it is presumed to be a trefa, it has the halachic status of a trefa, and the evidence of its living does not change the din that it is a trefa. Yaakov Emdin and the Derech Chaim say the same thing. The halacha defines the tzuadaka based on certain conditions of anatomical, physiological damage to the male reproductive organs, and even though Chazal also say, ein amolid, that he'll be sterile, the fact of his fertility does not change the halacha. Halacha still defines tzuadaka the way it does, he's still a tzuadaka, even if he has children. Yaakov Emdin suggests that even though the Gemara seems to say that's not possible, that's only a havmina of the Gemara, he suggests that l'maskana, tzuadaka is not linked with fertility, you can have a tzuadaka who's fertile, you can have someone who's infertile who's not a tzuadaka, that latter case is actually a fairly well-accepted rule. There are many cases in halacha l'maaseh that people are infertile because of anatomical damage to based on various reasons. We don't give them the status of tzuadaka, even though they are unquestionably infertile. Yaakov Emdin's chiddush is that l'maskana of the Gemara, the linkage is broken both ways, that even someone who is absolutely defined l'halacha as a tzuadaka can indeed be fertile. And he goes even further. He says that even Rav, who said Teva Chazar al-Banav, Rav didn't actually say that the status of Tzulah. He just said investigate, find out who the father really is, see what you can track down. He didn't go so far as to say that Halacha would rule them Tzulim, as the Beis Shmuel did. And further he says, when Chazal made their rule, Chazal meant, I'll be a rov. Eina mehanimna, it's not impossible, it's not out of the question, you can find an exception. Every rule has an exception. Halacha doesn't take into account the miyat, so I'm not sure why the Levush would say what he said. If Halacha doesn't take into account the miyat, I'm not sure how we can see his fertility and still not declare him a tzuadaka. Rechav Emden goes even further and says we won't declare the children from Mamzerim. That's what the Levush seems to say too. Why? If Halacha doesn't consider the miyat, we should assume the children are Mamzerim. But nevertheless, if the Isha is Becheskes Ksheira, if Yaakov Emdin wants to malamet chus, his language, lulmud v'nivreinus chus al abanim, we will not, unlike the Beis Shmuel, we will not rule that the children are mamzerim. We will try to preserve their kasher status. Derech Chaim too says basically the same thing. Doesn't explain logically what he means exactly, but he just says the halakhic definitions are what they are. Halakha defines p'tuadaka according to its criteria, and even though Chazal also said p'tuadaka ain't a molid, and we have a counterexample, we found one who is molid that does not refute the status of tzuadaka, we retain the halacha that he is a tzuadaka, we also accept that he fathered a child, and how can that be? He doesn't explain. We throw up our hands. But nevertheless, we cannot budge from Chazal's definition of tzuadaka. We also don't budge from the general conclusive presumption that a husband's children born in a marriage, are the husband. And how we resolve it, I don't know. We have two contradictory ideas in our head at the same time, as Fitzgerald said. But nevertheless, this is the position of the Levush, the Derech Chaim, or Yaakov Emdin. Most Acharonim, however, follow the Beis Shmuel that children born in a marriage where the husband is halakhically defined as a Tzuadaka or a Kris Shavcha cannot be his and are presumed to be mamzerim. Another context in which the normal chazakah that children born to a couple in holy matrimony nevertheless are not assumed to be the husbands, are assumed to be mamzerim. Another context is the case where the husband is away. So if the husband leaves town for a month or two and then a child is born 8 months later, obviously we assume that it was his child, that he fathered the child before he left, and it's a 9 month gestation. What if, however, the time that has elapsed between the birth of the child and the last moment at which the husband was here is more than 9 months? So the only way to assume that he's the father is by assuming that the woman had a gestation longer than the normal 9 months. Now, there is a sheet of the Bahag. The Bahag says that independent of assuming a long gestation, the husband may have returned, even though as far as we know he was out of town, he was in Medina Siam, he was out of the country. Nevertheless, it's possible that he secretly returned, that nobody knew about his return. That's the Levush, one opinion in Shulchan Aruch. That's the Bahag, one opinion in Shulchan Aruch. But other poskim disagree. Other poskim say if he's out of town, we take for granted that he stayed out of town. And the only way to machshir the child is by assuming an unusually long gestation. So, this discussion begins with the Gemara in Yevamos. Ovad Rabba Tosfa Uvda, there was apparently an actual case where Rabba Tosfa ruled the Isha Shalach Bala Medina Sayam, a woman whose husband was away in Medina Sayam in a foreign country, Vishtahi Atreser Yarche Shata, the time that had elapsed between his presence here with her and the birth of the child was 12 months, a year, the Akshere. Rabba Tosfa apparently ruled that we can conceive of a gestation that took 12 months. Most poskim accept this ruling of Rabba Tosfa l'halacha, the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch. The Rambam, however, when he codifies this ruling of Rabba Tosfa, he deliberately, notably changes the language to the negative. Instead of saying it could be that there was a gestation up to 12, he phrases it in the negative. Ein ha'ubar mishtav me'imo yesro al shnimasar chodesh. A fetus cannot tarry in the womb more than 12 months, and if it does, in other words, if more than 12 months have elapsed from the latest possible point of conception, the child is presumed to be a mamzer, and that is how the Shulchan Aruch rules. Each is Shayabalam Dinasayam, and Simon Dalad, Simon of Mamzeris, the Shah Shem Yester Yud Beit Sodesh, she was away for more than 12 months, the Yolda Achar Yud Beit Sodesh, and she gave birth 12 months, more than 12 months, Havlad Mamzer, the Vlad, the child is presumed to be a mamzer, She'ain Havlad Shah Bemeimo Yoster Yud Beit Sodesh. A fetus cannot tarry in the womb, the Rambam's language, more than 12 months. Yesh Misha Omer, then he brings the opinion of the Bahag, She'ena Bechetis Mamzer, and the reason is only because the husband may have returned, not because we entertain the possibility of a longer gestation, so the Mechaber Paskin, Sofik Mamzer. Most Achronim and most Poskim consider the ruling of the Shulchan Aruch normative, either with the Bahag or without the Bahag, but most Poskim do accept that a gestation of more than 12 months is absolutely not possible. There are, however, a not insignificant handful of Rishonim and Achronim that dissent, that say that it is indeed possible. At least in rare cases, Halacha does consider the possibility of a gestation even longer than 12 months. The Meiri says that once the Gemara is willing to consider a gestation of more than 12, of up to 12, even more than 12, he says, Af bi yeshem mishnei b'asar chodesh. Af bi yameinu, he says, in his day, there was Ira Maisa, there was a story, a woman whose gestation was apparently 15 months long, and nobody suspected her. Everyone was amazed at this bizarre, unbelievable occurrence. First they thought it was illness of some sort, then the child was born. Now he notes, the Rambam does say that's not possible. The Afra Bosa, he says, his teachers, his masters also testified that it's not possible. They cited Sif Sefer HaRafua, medical work, L'gidole HaChom Shabbat, to the greatest medical scholars. Ella, the Miri, says, what can I do? You're making arguments from authority, arguments from the Rambam, arguments from medical work. Ma'isa Shoya Kachaya. This was a case. We knew of such a case where a woman did have a gestation of 15 months. Nearly loving Bala Ma'isa. I would rule, he says, based on this occurrence, that it can't happen. We cannot say that it's impossible. Similarly, the Achronim cites a discussion of Remeir HaMe'ili, the author of the Sefer HaMe'oros. He says, Tarchin, where the Rambam get this from that it's not possible to have a gestation of more than 12? It's true that the statement of Rabba Tosfa was that he said it was kosher in a case of 12 months, Atreis or Yarche Shata. That was a Ma'at Shari, Kachai, it was 12 months. Maybe had the case been 15 months, as in the case of the Meiri, he would have been Machshir also. So some Achronim say the Lashon of Atreis or Yarche Shata, even though it was a Ma'at Shari, The linguistic implication is he deliberately said ad, meaning he was only makshir because the case fell within the boundary of 12 months. But it was a ma'aseh shaya, he says. Who knows? Maybe he would have been makshir even further. And just like the Meiri, he too says that he heard of a story of a longer gestation. Anisha mati, isha shenefko la atirim. She went into labor at the end of 9 months, and then the labor ceased, and there was another 9 months before she gave birth. And he says also, like the Meiri, that some of the Chachmei Derenu said, Ein Roi L'Pasul, not like the Rambam, that we don't rule a kid as a mamzer just because his gestation was apparently longer than 12 months. Like the Meiri, though, he says, he heard from the Chachmei Ateva, the scholars of science, the scientists, that they've written, Shelo Yuchal Eshtaz Yosem Yer Beis Chodesh, that scientifically they believed it was impossible. That was the Rambam's source. Not because the Gemara clearly indicates that it's impossible. The Rambam was basing himself on his medical knowledge. And indeed, the Urim Gedolim has a discussion with some other rabbi, or Rabbi Shlomo Havdalah, who had also mentioned, based on this Rav Meili, from Meir Meili, that there is indeed a possibility of a longer gestation, and that we can be mitzaref as a sniff, as a suffix, to not ruling the woman as an adulteress, not ruling the child as a mamzer, mitzaref with other possibilities. The Urim Gedolim himself says absolutely not. The Gemara is clear. He says ad treis or yarche, that ad means not further. That's the consensus of all the poskim. He says even the Bahag was only lenient because of the possibility that the husband returned, not because he in any way tolerates the idea of a gestation longer than 12 months. No posik says this. He says it's against nature, it's against science, it's against empirical evidence. The Rambam, he says, and even though normally he simply cites the Gemara, here he went out of his way to say, Ein ha'ubar mishtah, it cannot be. So halacha, we do not consider that possibility at all. And that's the consensus of most achronim. But again, there are some exceptions. The Chida cites a passage from Rabbi David Koronaldi, the author of the Beis David on Mishnayos, that he says, B'divrei ha'am shelahem, in the secular non-Jewish histories, there was an account of a wife of a Caesar that she had a gestation of 14 months, and that child eventually succeeded his father as Caesar. And again, he says that David Koronaldi suggested that when the Gemara says Tresi Achishata, Maisa Shai Kachaya, but even had the gestation been longer, as long as she's Bechetz of Kashrus, it would be fine. The Rambam says not like that. But, so nice, you have to be machmer, but there is such a possibility. In theory, at least, we have the secular account, we have the possibility of learning the Gemara, but Halacha, he says, we have to be machmer like the Rambam, like the Beit Yosef, that it is at least a Safek Mamza. Quote the Meiri. The Chida also says, Halacha, we don't follow this Meiri. The Meiri, he says, is a Matthias Rachuk Ma'od Ma'od, a very, very implausible case. Divrei Hayyam of the non-Jews, he says, Pshita Dein Lashkeh Divrei Hayyam Shalahem. That's just nonsense. We don't care what's written in their accounts. Meiri, whose account he takes seriously, he just says it was an outlier. It has no halakhic significance, as Yaakov Emden said about the Tzuadaka. Even if it's possible, maybe it's just an event with very, very low probability and it doesn't affect the halakha. Here, too, he says, even if the Meiri is correct that there was such a case, that's an event with such a tiny probability that it does not affect our halakhic calculus. There's a fascinating, truly, truly brilliant essay, A Tour de Force, by Rabbi Yehuda Stahl, in the end of his Amaros Taharos Kitonius Apnimios. My friend Eliezer Brutt once pointed this out to me. He has an essay of some 40 pages discussing all kinds of sources in Torah literature, and Halacha, and Agada, and Kabbalistic literature, all kinds of different accounts of gestations that lasted well beyond a year, including all the sources we've cited. He has a number of additional sources. He quotes various sources that Yisachar, the son of Yaakov, his gestation lasted 14 months or 13 months. Binyamin, the son of Yaakov, lasted 24 months or even 30 months. The Zohar seems to suggest that he was conceived before Yaakov's two-year sojourn immediately prior to his return to Eretz Canaan, and the gestation would have been 2 years, 24 months. Rabbi Yaakov Emden objects to that passage in the Zohar. He says it can't be, since we know that Yaakov was 2 months on the road from other traditional sources, 2 years on the road, and gestation can't be so long, it's against nature. Rabbi Stahl actually asks why he doesn't object to this against the Gemara, against the Halacha. As we've seen, it is against the Halacha, but it's not against the Gemara. The Gemara, several Achronim have pointed out, the Gemara does not necessarily mean that more than 12 months is impossible. The Gemara says, Ma'aseh Shaya Kachaya, the Achronim suggest. It could have been Ad Tresi Yarcheshat, it was that particular case. But in any event, it's certainly against the Halachic tradition. Rabbi Stahl also brings a tshuva of tshuva called Teferes Tzvi, discusses a case in Italy of an apparent 13-month gestation, and some poskim wanted to be lenient and not give the kid the status of a mamzer. It brought a fascinating argument from Yitzhak Avinu. It says Latzoni Hadar had believed that she had been conceived with Avimelech, and he had the nevuah that Ke'es Chaya shall have a child, and that was from one Pesach to the next, and he says it was a leap year. So he says the conception had already occurred earlier, around the time of Avimelech, and the delivery was not until 13 months later, a leap year. So Yitzhak Avinu himself had a gestation of longer than 12 months, according to the Sefer, according to his understanding of the Midrashim. In any event, Rabbi Stahl has numerous examples of sources of varying reliability in our tradition of gestations longer than 12 months, but as he notes repeatedly, as we've seen, the halakhic tradition categorically rules out this possibility, and even if there are some reliable sources, like the Meiri, like the Rav Meili perhaps, who say that there were cases of longer, even if we accept these accounts, we treat them as outliers that don't affect the halakhic process, and in general, there is a conclusive presumption that a gestation cannot take longer than 12 months, and the overwhelming consensus is that if a man is away from his home for more than 12 months, putting aside the Baha'i possibility of a secret return, the child will indeed be ruled a mamzer. One last area of halacha in which we allow evidence ruling out the possibility of the husband's paternity to override the normal presumption, the normal chazaka of Rav Yilat Zachar Abal, that children born to a married woman are his, concerns cases of forensic testing of blood, testing of DNA, that conclusively rule out the husband's paternity. In the modern period, this began to be a major discussion about 30, 40 years ago, well before they had DNA testing. Back in that time, there were testing of various blood factors, ABO testing. There was a major dispute among the poskim in Eretz Yisrael as to whether such testing was considered halakhically reliable. One of the major objections, aside from the questions of whether the science was sufficiently reliable, one of the major objections brought by many poskim was from a Braisa Nida. The Braisa says, Shlosha Shutafin Yesh Ba'adam, there are three partners in the creation of a person, Kosh Baruch Hu, father and mother, father, Mazriya Haloven, all the white parts of a person come from the father, Atamos, Begidim, Tiparnayim, Moach Shabarosho, Loven Shema'ayim, bones, sinews, nails, finger and toenails, brain, the white of the eye. The mother contributes the red part to a person, or basar, skin and flesh, vadam, and blood, also saros, hair, shachar shabayin, the black of the eye. Kadosh Baruch Hu gives the vital force, the life force, the animating force, ruach u'neshama, the soul, klas darpanov, the form of the face, riyas ha'ayin, sight, shmiyas ha'ozen, hearing, dibur peh, speech, hilach raglayim, locomotion, bina v'haskil, wisdom, intelligence. So the Braisa says, and this is a well-established thing in the Jewish tradition, that dam comes from the mother. So many poskim, beginning notably with Rabbi Uziel, therefore said that blood testing, ABO testing, cannot be used to establish or refute paternity because the blood has no relation to the father. Rabbi Uziel said, quite emphatically, Ein sompnel b'dikas ma'doyas shel dam ha'yelad, we do not rely on scientific testing of the blood, because we have a Kabbalah from Chazal, the blood is from the mother, not from the father. And he says quite strongly, Chol b'dika ma'doyas, any scientific test, even if we have scientific evidence for its reliability, mitbatelas neged kabbalasim hanamana shel razal, is void in the face of the reliable, authentic tradition of Chazal. Shekol devrei nemar baruch hakodesh, everything they say is baruch hakodesh. Baruch shebachar b'hem u'mishnasam. And this was the position of many achronim. Rav Yosef, Mr. Eliezer of Waldenberg, Mishnas Yaakov, and many others said, followed Rav Uziel and said, it's against the Chazal, and therefore we cannot rely on blood testing to determine or refute paternity. But there were dissenting views too. Not all Rabbanim agreed. Rav Shmuel Zalman said, perhaps we shouldn't take the Gemara at face value. Maybe the Gemara is speaking about metaphysical ideas, not making simple biological propositions. The most vehement, most passionate opponent to this view was Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, a trained scientist himself, writing to some other rabbi, we don't know who. He writes, Boshti v'nechlamti midivrei kvod gadlo. I'm embarrassed from the position you're taking, he says. B'yachas shel bittul, your dismissive attitude to blood testing, at least from blood testing from a negative testing to rule out paternity, which was very reliable, he says, there's no question, he says, it's something to do with the Nemanut HaRotem, it's well established, all the scientists agree, Kol Gedolei Hamad HaRafui B'chol Olam Kulo. It's not debatable, he says. Chazal didn't have a Lachal Moshe Mitzinais. He says, it can't be, they can't have a Lachal Moshe Mitzinais. It's not true, so obviously they didn't have a Lachal Moshe Mitzinais, he said. What Chazal said was based on the best science of their time. Ha'ol V'Aristo Kavakach, Aristotle had established these rules, Niskabel, Mipi Kol Chasam Sheba Olam. That was simply the best scientific information that they had. Science, there's no comparison, he says, between science in our day and science in Chazal's time. Science today, the global village, he says, a kesher sheyesh min kol chelkei ha'olam, the whole world is one large city, kilu erachas, he says. There's nothing to talk about, he says. There's no debate, he says. He says he can't disagree. And he winds up with an extremely acerbic comment, he says. Chaval, it's a great pity, he says. Sheba'od shamada holech b'kovish olamos. At the same time, the science is conquering worlds, Magala Sode Sodos, revealing the deepest, most intimate mysteries of creation. Imki Gamu Tal Aprakim, even though science, of course, doesn't always get everything right, occasionally it's wrong. Anu, at the same time, he says, with the great stride science is making, Anu Bekesher Lanyane Mada, relation to science, Anugam Tarsenu Akdosha, we, the rabbis he was challenging, Mishakim Rashenu Bechol, we sink our heads in the sand, Ka'ofa Yadua, like that well known bird, the ostrich, he means, that sticks his head in the sand and says, I don't see anything. He says, it's ridiculous, he says. The science is given. It's reliable. It works, he says. How can you stick your head in the sand and deny that it works? Because I was simply issuing rulings based on the best science of their day. And indeed, Raziel's position is somewhat difficult to accept. Certainly today, the science is even more better supported than it was in his day. And in general, as of Herzog notes, many Rishonim, the Gaon, and many Rishonim said the Chazal were not doctors. Chazal simply ruled based on the best science of their day. Not everything they said in matters of science and medicine were based on what we've seen. There were others who disagreed, but certainly there is basis for a dissenting view. And I believe today, certainly with DNA testing, Rabbi Yashiv and many others have said that DNA testing is reliable and that we do rely on it, even for questions like Haguna. In general, DNA testing may avoid the particular question of blood typing. We don't necessarily have to test the blood. But in general, this was a major dispute beginning around 30, 40 years ago. Rabbi Dov Reimer has an excellent write-up of the sugya, published in Shnasan HaMishpat Ivri and in Asya, available elsewhere. So this was a major machlokas, and this discussion was relevant to many areas of halacha, where paternity is relevant. Child support, whether a man who is a putative father can be forced to pay child support, can we determine or refute his paternity based on blood testing, mamzerus. Regarding specifically Mamzerus, we have a very interesting discussion. As it turns out, the idea of blood testing is not new. It was discussed in the medieval period already. There is a truly fascinating account in the Sefer Chasidim. Sefer Chasidim is discussing the idea of fasting when a father dies. One explanation he gives for that is Ha'av Ha'ben Guf Echad, a father and a son are like one flesh, they're the same body. And in support of that, he brings this fascinating episode. He says there was an event that occurred in the time of Rav Sadia, Ben Yosef, the Gaon Rav Sadia. Someone traveled to Medina Sayam with a servant and lots of money and left behind his wife, pregnant wife. The man died, and the Eved usurped the position of the son and declared himself as the son. When the son grew up, he challenged the Eved's claim, and he had no proof, though. So the Eved said, I'm the son. The son said, no, you're not. You're the Eved. So the son was afraid. The Eved was connected by marriage to a powerful family. The son was afraid of being killed. He went to Rav Sadia. He told Rav Sadia his sad tale of woe. He wouldn't eat until he related his story. Rav Sadia said, go to the king. The king himself didn't know how to resolve the matter. The king sent for Rav Sadia. Rav Sadia performed a very modern forensic experiment. He told both candidates for son to contribute some blood into separate bowls. Then he took a bone from the dead father. He dipped the bone into both bowls of blood. The bowl of blood from the Eved, the blood was not absorbed in the bone. The blood of the son was absorbed in the bone. Why? Ki guf echad. That's this principle that a father and son are guf echad. So Rav Sadia said, oh, he took the money and gave it all to the son, Shalom al Yisrael, and everyone was happy, except the Eved, I guess. This story actually is attributed to Shlomo HaMelech, but at the very least, it's a medieval account that they had a notion of blood testing. The Elia Rabbah, in his commentary on Aruch Chaim, raises an interesting question. He mentions a Gemara in Bava Basra. The Gemara says that Rabbi Benah, was investigating the graves of, not the graves, that was an earlier Gemara. It says that there was a story where a man heard his wife say, she confessed to her daughter of her adultery. She said, I have 10 sons, and only one of them is from my husband. So the husband who had overheard this said, okay, I'm giving all my property, I'm leaving it all over to my one real son. How do we figure out who is the true son? So they went to Rabbi Noah. Rabbi Noah said the following idea. He said, have all the sons file past the grave, and each one should kick the grave, and that would stimulate that the father would arise from the dead and declare who the true son was. So 9 out of the 10 sons indeed filed past the grave and kicked the grave. One son wouldn't do it. He said, a sense of delicacy, a sense of respect for his father, he couldn't do such a thing. So Rabbi Noah said, he's the true son. He's the one who can't bring himself to kick his father's grave. Incidentally, this basic story appears, variations of this story appear in various cultures. There is a charming Russian folktale, the elephant's birthday party, that someone ate up all the elephant's birthday cake, and the animals, the various guests, the animals, nobody knew who it was. So the marmot said, I have a plan. I have a magic pot, he said. Let all the animals walk by the pot and dip their paws in the pot and touch the bottom of the pot. This pot, when the thief touches it, will cry out and scream, he's the thief. So all the animals did this, and after doing this, the pot did not, of course, cry out, but all the animals began to notice that their hands were covered with soot, except the cat. The cat's hands were clean. The marmot said, Ata ha'ish, you're the ganav. He said, the pot is not magic. I just took a bunch of soot and put it on the bottom of the pot. And I knew that the thief would be superstitious, would believe me, would be afraid of the pot. He was afraid to touch the pot. So you, the cat, you're the thief. You ate all the birthday cake. Other stories in other cultures, John Napier, the eccentric and brilliant Scottish mathematician, once had a problem with a servant stealing things, so he was believed to have had a black magic cock, a rooster, who was believed to have magic powers. He told all the suspects to go touch the rooster, and the rooster would announce who the thief was. And instead, he had covered the rooster with soot, and the thief refused to touch the rooster. V'chehena, v'chehena. So that was what Rabbi Noah did. He established who the son was by this sort of trick. So the Rabbi asks, why did he have to resort to a trick? Why couldn't he simply perform a forensic blood test? If Rav Sadia knew how to do it, if this is an ancient Jewish tradition, why couldn't he simply perform this trick? So the Rashash asked this question. Various Akronim give various explanations. Rav Yashiv suggests that perhaps Meis Asur B'Hana, you're not allowed to derive benefit from a cadaver. So the son coming into his Yerusha will be called Hana. So maybe you can't do that. Yitzchak Isaac Libus in the Beis Avi discusses this question regarding blood testing for paternity. He says maybe it's a question of nivola mace. Who said we're allowed to disinter the mace and take off pieces of him for this purpose? Whole discussion of nivola mace. But the Rashash has an interesting idea. The Rashash says, had we done a blood test, that would have conclusively determined that he's not the father, and therefore it would be revealed that all the other children were mamzerim. Rabbi Noah didn't want that, he said. Since al pi halacha, the woman's statement had no halachic weight, so he didn't want to do an experiment which would have resulted in outing mamzerim. That's a general rule in mamzerus. We don't try to be marba mamzerim. And Rabbi Noah's test was just a hashara. It was just a kind of speculation, even though it was enough to paskin dina mamonis, shoot a dedina, whatever reason he was allowed to use such a test to paskin a civil dispute. But it wouldn't have the conclusive weight, and it wouldn't allow us to conclusively conclude they were mamzerim. They can go on living their lives as before. And we deliberately don't want to do a test which will reveal mamzerus when, according to strict halacha, we have no reason to believe in mamzerus. And Rav Yashiv adduces this Rashash in support of the same idea. He was asked about a woman who also had declared in the modern time that her child was a mamzer, was not from her husband. And of course, according to halacha, she has no nemanus. We don't believe what she says, but the question was, should we do a DNA test? Rav Yashiv in general is cited as having believed that DNA tests were reliable and do have halacha consequences. And here also, we seem to take for granted that had we done the test, were we to do the test, we would accept its conclusions. The question simply is, should we do the test? And Rav Yashiv says, no, we should not. He says, the woman is not nemanus. And he says that, he says, therefore, Kivan Shavru Harbe Shanim of Halacha Huxtiku Bibito, since the child has been presumed to be the child of the husband, Ein Shum Tchus Lahatl Dofi Bibito, no one has the right to start raising questions and saying maybe she's a, really a Mamzeret, no one has the right to open this case now and start doing forensic testing, whether it's her child or not, whether it's his child or not, certainly her child. They bring Dali Rabba and the Rashash that as a support for this idea that we do not want to, if we don't have to, if according to Halacha there's no actual suffix, we do not open the Pandora's box, we don't look to raise questions by doing DNA testing. On the one hand, as we said, Rabbi Yashiv seems to assume that the blood testing, the DNA testing, whatever test that we're going to do, would indeed be reliable, and it might indeed require us to conclude that the child is a mamzer, but we don't do it. If according to Halacha we have no suffix, we don't begin testing just to be extra certain.
The Daf Yomi Halacha series has been brought to you by the Beis Havad Halacha Center. To sign up for the Halacha Center's weekly interactive e-journal, please email subscribe to info@thehalachacenter.org.